It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A suicide bombing occurs shortly after an appearance by the president of Nigeria. A suicide bomber detonated her explosives Monday outside a stadium in Gombe shortly after President Goodluck Jonathan left a campaign rally. The bomber was the only fatality. Nearly 20 others were wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion is likely to fall on Boko Haram militants who have attacked the area several times. On Sunday, a suicide attack in the town killed 5. Violence is on the rise as Nigeria's February 14th presidential election approaches. Mr. Jonathan's chief rival, former General Muhammadu Buhari, told campaign supporters in Yola he will improve security if elected. Meanwhile, workers collected bodies in the Borno state capital Maiduguri Monday, a day after the army repelled another attempt by Boko Haram to take control of the city. The Nigerian military, meanwhile, is claiming progress against the Islamist insurgency, retaking Gamboro and 4 other towns in a joint offensive that involved vigilantes and forces from Chad and Cameroon. The U.S. says it's not made a decision whether to provide Ukraine lethal military assistance in its fight against Russian-backed separatists. U.S. spokesperson Jen Psaki said no options have been taken off the table and there's ongoing discussions.
So I'm not going to go into details of internal policy discussions, but we do continue to assess how to best support Ukraine. Our focus does remain on pursuing a solution through diplomatic means, and we are always evaluating other options that will help create space for a negotiated solution to the crisis.
Fighting is raged in the self-declared separatist regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, especially around a Ukrainian-controlled town of Dubotseve, since peace talks in Belarus between the government and separatists collapsed on Saturday. This is VOA News. Yemeni tribal and security officials say a U.S. drone strike Monday killed at least 4 suspected al-Qaeda insurgents, the third American drone strike attack in a week. Washington's launched more than 100 such attacks, mostly drones, against militants in the unsettled Arabian Peninsula country since 2009. Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresta says it was a relief to be freed from an Egyptian prison, but that he feels incredible angst about leaving 2 colleagues behind. Speaking in Cyprus Monday, Gresta said his release is a massive step forward for Egypt. He hopes the country will keep going down this path with his colleagues Bahar Mohamed and Mohamed Fahmy.
Now, you spend 400 days in such close proximity with people, and you really get to know them very, very well. So it was a very difficult moment walking out of that prison, saying goodbye to those guys, not knowing how much longer they will have to put up with this.
Egypt deported Gresta Sunday. He was serving a 7-year prison term for allegedly aiding the banned Muslim Brotherhood. Meanwhile, an Egyptian court has sentenced nearly 200 supporters of Muslim Brotherhood to death on charges of killing several policemen following the 2013 ouster of President Mohamed Morsi. U.S. spokesperson Psaki acknowledged Egypt's responsibility to bring justice to those accused.
However, the United States is deeply concerned by the decision of an Egyptian court to uphold 183 mass death sentences. It simply seems impossible that a fair review of evidence and testimony could be achieved through mass trials. We continue to call on the government of Egypt to ensure due process for the accused on the merits of individual cases for all Egyptians and discontinue the practice of mass trials.
Since Mr. Morsi's overthrow, the government has jailed tens of thousands of Muslim Brotherhood members and supporters. The Ugandan army Monday said it may have found the body of Lord's Resistance Army commander Okot Odhiambo, wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. He was the deputy to LRA Chief Joseph Kony. Testing is underway to determine the body's identification. A new report Monday says flooding that ravaged northern and central parts of Mozambique killed 159 people and affected some 160,000. Zambezia province is the worst affected. Heavy rains have inundated the country over the weekend. Lesotho's military on Monday rejected the government's allegation it was to blame for a shootout Sunday at a military checkpoint in the capital Maseru that killed a bystander and wounded 2 bodyguards of the prime minister. The incident occurred less than a month before national elections are scheduled in the tiny African kingdom and follows last August's attempted coup that forced Prime Minister Thomas Thabane to briefly flee to South Africa. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian officials are pleased with turnout of the first Ebola vaccine trials.
We were able to explain to the Liberian people what are the benefits of the trial, that the trial vaccine cannot give you Ebola. It is intended to provide lasting solution.
Tobin Yeswa is Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services. South Sudan's warring parties agree on a framework for a transitional government. There have been more reactions to the election of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe as the next African Union chairman. And Nigeria's military is confident it can secure the country for the February 14 elections.
First of all, I must make it clear that, like we have said repeatedly, every part of Nigeria is intact, and we don't accept any reference or claim to the fact that anyone holds control of any part thereof illegally.
General Chris Olukolade is Director of Defense Information for the Nigerian military, and oil deposits in northern Kenya fuel violent intercommunal conflicts. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Liberian health ministry official says the government is pleased with the number of people who turned out on Monday to participate in the first human trials of two potential Ebola vaccines. Tolbo Nyeswa, Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services and head of the country's Ebola response, says authorities were able to explain to the people that the vaccine does not give people Ebola. On the contrary, Nyeswa said if the vaccine is effective, Liberia will make history by being the first country to help in finding a lasting solution to the deadly epidemic.
I think the first day of the trial went very well. The investigators already enrolled 9 persons that have already been inoculated. We were able to explain to the Liberian people what are the benefits of the trial, that the trial vaccine cannot give you Ebola. It is intended to provide lasting solution. And Liberia is making history among nations in the world that if this vaccine is efficacious and effective, we can find a lasting solution of prevention for the Ebola virus disease that struck the region, both Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, on a very unprecedented level.
So is your government impressed by the number of people who turn out to be vaccinated, because there have been fears that they have been used as guinea pigs?
The thing is, we have to provide more information to our population, which is what we're doing right now. This is a new phenomenon to try vaccine, especially when an outbreak is already ongoing. And so the speculation and the skepticism of the population is reasonable. But what we need to do is to provide additional information to them, what the vaccine is about, and give them all of the information that is needed. And so we are doing this. The fact that we had a number of persons that turned up, took the vaccine, and even spoke to radio, local radio stations today, about their own experience about the first inoculation at the Redemption Hospital, which has a state-of-the-art laboratory equipment to carry on this vaccine trial. And so what we hope for is that everything should go well so that Liberia can enter the public health global community to show that, yes, this is a place that will find a lasting solution for Ebola, because prevention is better than cure, and having a vaccine for Ebola is highly critical for the world.
Does your government or the Ministry of Health or the Liberian government, is there a particular target number of people that you hope to give this experimental vaccine?
This is the first site that we started, and this site is expected to inoculate 600 people, and then find additional sites in Monrovia and outside of Monrovia as the situation dictates, to get about 27,000 people. But with the very decrease and decline number of the Ebola virus disease in Liberia, I know we will work with partners and other countries in the region.
Tobu Nyeswa is Liberia's Assistant Minister of Health for Preventive Services. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. The Director of Defense Information for Nigeria's military said the army is in full control of all territories within the country's borders, contrary to what he called misleading reports that the militant group Boko Haram controls Borno State and has surrendered Maiduguri, the biggest city in the northeast of the country. General Chris Olukolade said Nigeria is enjoying the collaboration and support of military organizations from neighboring countries within the multinational joint task force. Olukolade's remarks follow reports that President Goodluck Jonathan on Monday escaped a suspected suicide bomb blast after he left a campaign rally in the city of Gombe in northeast Nigeria. Olukolade said the military remains confident it can secure Nigeria for the coming February 14th election.
First of all, I must make it clear that, like we have said repeatedly, every part of Nigeria is intact, and we don't accept any reference or claim to the fact that anyone holds control of any part thereof illegally. Yes, there are areas where the activities of terrorists are prevalent, and we are moving on such areas to clear them off such places. The operation is progressing as expected. We are enjoying the collaboration and understanding as well as support of our neighboring countries and military organizations within the multinational joint task force.
There have been questions raised that your military did not make progress until Chad came.
First of all, I must clarify this impression. It is not true that until Chad came, we were not making progress. What we needed was for our neighbors to move on them from their territories so that the places they used to operate as their safe haven could be untenable for them. And we had the cooperation of our neighbors in this respect. And that is why we are making the present progress. It is not for any wrong impression that there was no sufficient move from Nigeria. There was, but it was totally aborted by the fact that they had safe haven in neighboring places. Now that our neighbors have collaborated with us effectively, all those safe havens have become untenable and they have no place to run to.
General, does your military have any information? We understand there was a bomb blast in an area, I think the city of Gombe, where the president, Goodluck Jonathan, was supposed to come to speak. What can you tell us?
Well, we are here to understand what actually happened there. For the fact that what you are saying is contrary to what we are hearing from the police in that area, I would depend on whatever the police says actually happened. There's a lot of misinformation going around now. There's a lot of anxiety that makes people present any situation as more terrible than it actually is. Until we hear the clear description of what happened from the police, we'd rather say let's wait and see.
So let me ask you point-blank questions. General, do you think your military and the joint task force will be able to control Boko Haram so that the coming elections can be saved?
We remain very, very optimistic, especially in view of the progress we have made within the past few days. We believe that our mission of ensuring that the entire environment is secure for appropriate socioeconomic and political activities will be attained. And if the election benefits from that arrangement, why not?
General Chris Olukolade is Director of Defense Information for Nigeria's military. He was speaking with me from Abuja, Nigeria. South Sudan warring parties have signed a framework power-sharing transitional government agreement. South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael Makui, told reporters Monday that the agreement was signed by President Salva Kiir and former Vice President and rebel leader Riek Machar. Makui says the government provides a clear timeline for ending the conflict and forming a transitional government of national unity, which government officials believe can be in place by April this year. However, and as Philip Aton Aliu reports from Juba, Makui cautions that several issues must still be resolved once negotiations resume later this month.
Makui says the outstanding issues to be discussed later this month include the structure of a transitional government and the powers of the president and his deputies. He says the two-week break gives President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar ample time to consult with their respective constituencies and hopefully reach a peace deal by the end of March.
Up to the end of March, the negotiators will continue to work out the implementation modalities, and by the 30th of March, the whole agreement would have been signed so that the pre-transitional period starts on the 1st of April.
The structure of the transitional government, including clarification of the powers of the two deputy presidents, are expected to be implemented by April 1st. But Makui says the government is still not in complete agreement with the IGAD-mediated power-sharing proposal for first vice president and second vice president.
We are saying there is no first vice president, there is no vice president, there will be two vice presidents with equal status, so that their competencies are delegated to them by the president in accordance with the provisions of our constitution.
Makui says the two parties have agreed on the composition of a national legislative assembly, but note that further discussions are needed on that matter. He says both parties are optimistic a ceasefire will be respected this time.
We have not been signing so many agreements. All that we sign is the cessation of hostilities. All the other resolutions were resolutions of the summit of the African Union. This time, what is agreed now between the two principals is the first agreement, and they are committed to respect and abide by the provisions of their agreement.
Nearly 2 million people have been forced away from their homes by the conflict, which erupted in December 2013. Both sides have repeatedly violated the first cessation of hostilities agreement signed in January 2014. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. While some Zimbabweans view President Robert Mugabe's election to the African Union chairmanship as Africa's recognition of his experience in international relations, others say there is not much that Mr. Mugabe would change, as his new post is largely ceremonial. Erwin Chifera of VOA Zimbabwe Service has details from Harare.
Mr. Mugabe, who is also chairperson of the Southern African Development Community, was unanimously elected African Union chairperson last week in what ZANU-PF's Gabriel Chaiva says is a tremendous show of support and confidence on him by African leaders.
There is no doubt in my mind that the election of President Mugabe as the chairperson of the African Union is yet another very clear indication of a tremendous amount of respect the continental body has, the confidence that they have in the leadership of President Robert Mugabe. It could have been anybody else.
Chaiva says as AU chairman, Mr. Mugabe now has a perfect opportunity to change the mindset of certain leaders who believed that America and Europe are the saviors of Africa's challenges. Political commentator Takura Jangaja also says Mr. Mugabe's election to chair the continental body is good, as it marks Zimbabwe's entry into international affairs after years being regarded as a pariah state.
I think the significance is that it's sort of now coming in from the cold and being recognized by member states of the African Union to have the capacity and legitimacy to be chairperson of the AU. In other words, it is no longer being mediated. So it's a new entry of Zimbabwe into international affairs, which is a good thing.
Senior Zimbabwean journalist David Masunda adds that Mr. Mugabe's election will boost his image internationally, as the West, which has imposed sanctions on him and his colleagues, can no longer afford to ignore him.
Whereas in the past they could ignore him, now they cannot afford to. And in the forceful character that he is not just going to be a ceremonial African head of state like some of the most recent ones. He's somebody who pushes agendas, and these agendas are very well known.
Masunda says Mr. Mugabe's leadership of both the Southern African Development Community and African Union is good news for countries like China and Russia, as the Zimbabwean leader is likely to push his policies, such as the Look East policy. Reporting from Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
More than 2 years after Kenya struck oil for the first time in its northernmost county, Turkana, the two ethnic groups that live on either side of the oil reserves are engaging in violent, often deadly armed conflicts. For centuries, they have competed for land and access to water points, but now they want a stake in the oil wealth. Jessica Hatcher reports from the southern part of the county, where the Turkana community is living in fear of attacks from the neighboring Pokots.
It is early morning in the south of Turkana, Across the county, community herders gather for security meetings. Armed conflict is nothing new here. But since Kenya found oil just 60 kilometers from here, the conflict has worsened, Turkana herders say.
Currently, the conflict with the Pokot is at its worst. In the past, it was only cattle raids, but now they attack also the villages and displaced people.
With the two tribes locked in a cycle of retaliatory violence, negotiation will be needed to resolve differences. But some observers, like Father Nicholas Kimenjo, say that won't be easy with so much at stake.
The political leaders told the Pokots that if you fought for us, we shall drive these Turkanas up to Lokijar. Because their aim now is, since the oil is there, if we also attain this to be our property, we shall have a monopoly of the property and we can prosper.
Whole villages have been burnt to the ground and unarmed civilians killed. Last year, Lekwa was a busy village with a thriving primary school. Now, neatly thatched homes have been destroyed, sending a clear warning to the residents not to return, says teacher Paul Idoket Ekitela.
They are burning. They are person. Because that person was killed on the way coming to this place. He was not fighting, but he was digging his shamba.
The annihilation of villages is new to the more traditional tribal conflict between the Pokot and the Turkana, which previously revolved around livestock. Now it is developing into a scorched earth campaign, a form of land wrestling that works by creating so much insecurity that people move away. Caught in the middle of the Pokot-Turkana conflict is the Anglo-Irish exploration company Tullow Oil, which claims to have found an estimated 600 million barrels of oil beneath Turkana, with potential for a billion in total. To operate in such a sensitive and historically marginalised environment requires oil companies to tread carefully, says Tullow's Andy Dimitriou.
People live off the land still. They still live in the way they lived hundreds of years ago, in most cases. Here you have big industry and technology coming in with pastoralist communities. There's always going to be challenges. We're not going to agree on everything.
Despite its buried wealth, Turkana is the poorest region in Kenya. Oil presents a tremendous opportunity for development. But critics like Turkana activist Lopeok Ricardo Simeon fear that the local communities here are being cut out of the equation by the government in Nairobi.
And the government claims that whatever is between on the earth and below the surface is theirs. It is true. But we need to be consulted also because whatever is embedded on the earth, we have to be consulted because we are the owners of the land. We also want to have a take in this process.
As the value of this land grows, so will the incentive and desire to control it. If this conflict is not resolved, Turkana's black gold could be a curse rather than a blessing. Jessica Hatcher for VOA News, Turkana, Kenya.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsor here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin at the Orange Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. Ghana's Black Stars have improved with every successive match, the Ghana coach Avram Grant told the media in Malabo on Monday. He noted that the team suffered an initial setback against Senegal in their opening tie. From then on, they have prevailed over their opponents, Algeria, South Africa and Guinea, with an increasingly convincing style in each encounter. Coach Grant is satisfied with his playing unit. He emphasizes that whoever gets the nod to play performs to the best of his ability. Meanwhile, Tunisia's Ahmed Akaisi, Republic of Congo's Thierry Bifuma, and Equatorial Guinea's Javier Balbao are so far the joint top scorers at the Nations Cup, having each found the back of the net three times. They are followed by six players who have each scored two goals. What's more, they still have a chance to increase their goal tally in the coming matches. These players are Ivory Coast's Winfred Boni and Alain Max Gradel, Ghana's Andre Ayew and Christian Atsu, along with the Democratic Republic of Congo's Jeremy Bokila and Diomerci Bokani. Staying with goal scoring, a total of 61 goals have been scored in 28 matches. Ghana are the most prolific with 7 goals to their names. Algeria, Republic of Congo, Ivory Coast and the Democratic Republic of Congo are jointly second with 6 goals each, while Equatorial Guinea and Tunisia share third spot with 5 goals apiece. Finally, in Switzerland, 4 candidates have met the initial requirements to contest the FIFA presidential elections FIFA disclosed in Zurich on Monday. Their incumbent, President Sepp Blatter, Asia Football Confederation Vice President Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, former Portugal attacking midfielder Luis Figo, and Netherlands Football Association head Michael van Braag. Each candidate's dossier is to be subject to an integrity check by the FIFA Ethics Committee before they are declared fit to run for the FIFA presidential elections due on the 29th of May in Zurich. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. February is Black History Month celebration here in the United States, and every morning during the month of February, Daybreak Africa will profile historical African American and African individuals and events. Now, here are our Black History Month and African History facts for today, February 3rd. On this day in 1903, boxer John Jack Johnson became the first black heavyweight champion. His victory over Denver F. Martin established him as the unofficial black heavyweight champion. Also on this day in 1920, the first Negro Baseball League was founded. Before 1947, blacks were not allowed to play white Major League Baseball. But in 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first black man to play in the white Major League. On this day in 1956, Authorine J. Lucy became the first black student to attend the University of Alabama. She was expelled 3 days later for her own safety in response to threats from a white mob consisting of both university students and non-students from the surrounding communities. On this day in 2007, United States Senator Barack Obama announced his presidential intentions in Springfield, Illinois. Also on this day in 1948, Rosa Lee Ingram, a sharecropper and widow, was sentenced to die by electric chair along with two of her teenage boys in the state of Georgia after being found guilty in a one-day trial for the murder of white landowner John Stratford. There are several accounts of what actually took place. However, a national committee led by Mary Church Terrell was set up to free the Ingram family. It went as far as appealing to President Harry Truman to intervene. Finally, in 1959, Mrs. Ingram and her two sons were granted parole and released. And on this day in African history in 1985, Desmond Umpilo Tutu became the first black Anglican Archbishop of Johannesburg, South Africa. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 3rd. Now, here is our question for today, February 3rd. Who started the first Black History Month celebration? Once again, who started the first Black History Month celebration? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your answer. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Tuesday, February 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post-editor Mark O'Woman, along with our engineer Jim Harmon, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, and throughout the month of February, we're collaborating with our partner, Channels TV in Lagos, Nigeria, to bring you a series of programs with complete, in-depth coverage of the upcoming Nigerian presidential election. We'll discuss and dissect all the important issues. That's next time and throughout February on VOA Africa.
VOA. On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.